The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Please welcome the most senior correspondent from The Daily Show, Samantha Bee.
Hello. I didn't realize that I was going to be provided with a complimentary Butterfinger for coming to the... That is exciting. That is good news for me, I can tell you. Well, thank you all for coming. I am so surprised to see such a nice big crowd. I am thrilled. I thought you would all be outside steaming in your own skin like potatoes. So I'm not going to talk too much. Oh, it's so funny. I'm 8 months pregnant. You can see. Obvious. Thank you. Please. No applause required. It's my third. But I am leaning. I'm bumping up again. I'm going to knock the whole podium over with my belly. So I'm going to be hunched like this because it's the only way that I can actually do this. I don't have bad posture normally. So I will say, to preface this, that I don't know why I wrote the book exactly. I'm not really sure. It was really at the intersection of probably one of the busiest times of my life. I had just given birth to my second child, and we were just going into the election season. It was kind of a crazy endeavor, probably equal parts masochism and narcissism. I don't know. But anyway, here we are today, 2 years later. And I'm going to read one of the stories from the book. It is the story of my spiritual awakening. Yes. And then I think I'm going to take some questions from the audience. If you're interested, if there's something you want to know about the show, I give you the goods. Get really juicy. And then I'd be happy to meet with you and do whatever you like in the lobby. We can dance around. You can deliver my baby. Please, I would appreciate that. Okay, so I'm just going to go ahead and begin. This story is entitled Man Witch. Okay. For about 9 years, from the age of 3 until I was 12 or so, Jesus was totally my boyfriend. Not my flesh and blood boyfriend, of course, but for a pre-preteen, it was close enough. I was a patient person. I knew that one day he would make himself known to me and we would be able to actualize the throbbing Tiger Beat style LUV that we felt for each other. It's not that I wanted to be a nun or anything, au contraire. No. I was attending a Catholic school at the time, so I knew that living in a convent would mean a lifetime of deprivation and nurse's shoes. Besides, half the nuns there looked and smelled like the rejection of life itself. I mean, these were women whose dandruff could settle like coconut shavings on top of their eyebrows. They wouldn't even notice. The other half were just plain mean and clearly savored the terrifying effect they had on people. You could see that they had all their lady parts, but you just knew that once a month they menstruated dust. Who would want to join a club like that? So I didn't need to be a bride of Christ. I was comfortable just dating him. And if things got a little more serious, then that was cool too. But one thing was certain. He and I were together. When I talked to him, it was as intimate as if I had picked up my Hot Lips phone and dialed directly to his condo in heaven. I had a notebook dedicated to ironing out the details of my postmarital name change, Samantha Christ, Mrs. Jesus Christ, Lamb of God, Mrs. Samantha H. Christ. I didn't know what the H stood for, but whenever my father took the Lord's name in vain, he always added it for some reason. I thought it gave everything a nice rhythm. In fact, Jesus and I were so tight that if any moment he should materialize, I knew we would listen to my disco records and eat Tang straight from the package, just like lovers did. I was ready. Jesus was everywhere I looked at school, hanging on the walls, pictured in my books, overseeing my hand washing at the miniature sink, casting a benevolent eye on me as I spray painted the Christmas angels I had made from old legs containers. My Catholic school was considered progressive, which meant that my Jesus wasn't blood-soaked and scary, hanging from the cross with his eyes rolled back into his head in the final agonizing release of his life force, although there was a place in my heart for that guy, too. My Jesus was cool. He looked like Kris Kristofferson, circa A Star Is Born, only with penetrating blue eyes and a non-threatening admiration for children that I, as a child, both understood and appreciated. He wore a freshly pressed robe all the time, but you knew he had a great ass and could have pulled off a pair of jeans and worn out cowboy boots, even if you weren't sure why you would want that. Jesus had nice, big, rough hands with clean fingernails, so you knew that he could chop down a tree if he had to, but that he could also handle a kitten with tenderness. He had a lustrous but well-maintained chest full of hair, because, as the Son of God, he was bound to be hairy only in all the right places. As if Jesus would have little stray sprouts on his shoulders or the bridge of his nose. Unthinkable! Picture myself lying beside Jesus in a field of sweet grass, my fingers entwined in his chest hair in a non-sexual way. We'd laugh and talk, and I'd wash his feet with exotic oils and then dry them with my hair. I never questioned it. It was just what you did when you were with Jesus. Of course, Jesus was Jesus, and that meant he could be unpredictable, too. He was always on the verge of materializing in some crazy place you never knew when or where. A person had to be prepared to get down on their hands and knees and wash and dry those precious Jesus feet, and I was. I play a game with myself as I walk down the street. If Jesus appeared to me right now, where would I get a big bowl to put his feet in? I'd wonder. If I go into that diner, would there then be a dish towel for him to sit on so that he doesn't sully his robe? I challenge myself to see Jesus and all the panhandlers. What if that guy in the poo stained tracksuit was Jesus? Could I really dry his feet with my hair? Of course I could, as soon as his Jesusness was definitively proven by way of either A, careful inspection of his crucifixion wounds, or B, some kind of unearthly glow, possibly, hopefully, in the form of a halo. Jesus was no slouch. When he sang to me, which he often did in my girlhood fantasies, he always sounded a bit like Kenny Loggins. Another bearded dude I was quite fond of, most likely because he reminded me of Jesus. And I loved that he had a temper. I mean, most of the time he was quite level-headed, but when he banished those merchants from the temple in a fury, that's when I knew he was real husband material. Not that he would be violent with me, but because the fact that he could get a bit hot under the collar meant that he was passionate, a bit of a roughneck, the kind of guy who would defend my honor as required. It didn't hurt that his representative in my life was a smoking hot priest at school named Father Andy. With Jesus busy, he was gorgeous. With Jesus busy elsewhere, Father Andy was a suitable flesh and blood substitute for my affections. He didn't have Jesus' sexual magnetism, but he wore robes all the time and looked enough like Peter Frampton to make an impression. Father Andy's laissez-faire attitude was supposed to turn us on to Christ in a fresh, hip, non-judgmental way, but in the end turned us on to something completely different, including jealousy. Fancying myself the only girl in class mature enough to handle a long-term relationship, I was shocked when all of the other girls simultaneously discovered cosmetics the moment Father Andy started coming into our classroom. One day I walked into class and all of these formerly fresh-scrubbed girls were wearing shimmery pink lip glosses in various shades of horror. The boys tried to impress Father Andy, too, with their knowledge of chokeholds and physical restraints. Within minutes of his arrival, all of the boys would suddenly be on the floor in Greco-Roman wrestling positions, sweating and grappling with one another as Father Andy looked on casually. It was a sexually confusing time for the girls and boys alike, but I secretly knew that I was above it. All of that other stuff was just child's play. My path to his heart, I figured, would be through my intelligent questioning of the faith. I thought that if I just asked the right philosophical questions, I would impress Father Andy with my worldliness, and then we would hug each other tightly and run away from the church together to raise baby rabbits for a living. When we were asked to write about our faith, I specifically indicated that I didn't believe in some bearded man sitting up in a throne in heaven with angels all around him, which I thought made me seem edgy and cool and would make me stand out. Unfortunately, since I literally believed that God was a bearded man sitting upon a throne in heaven with angels all around him, I didn't have much to say when Father Andy asked me to elaborate. I mean, sitting in a chair with angels all around him, I think God would find that a bit boring, don't you? It was really grasping at straws. I mean, why would he sit when he obviously possesses the power of flight and the ability to hurl lightning bolts at stuff? There's no way he'd sit around when he is capable of levitating and smiting things. That would be ridiculous. My best opportunity to impress him, I figured, would be at our annual church retreat, a 2-day overnight camping trip on the grounds of a Catholic fat camp called Camp Meshukwuk, which loosely translated means cows in Mohawk. I pulled out all the stops. My red satin jacket with the ice cream cone patch, my rattiest and therefore most red miniature picture Bible, and even though I didn't need it, an inch-thick application of Bon Bell Dr. Pepper Lip Smacker lip gloss to ensure that I was closed-mouth kissable. Titillated beyond belief, I tried to look casual when Father Andy smoked a cigarette and drank a glass of wine around the campfire. Cigarette. What a dirty birdie. But on the outside, I was as cool as a cucumber. I mean, who among us didn't enjoy unwinding with liquor and smokes in the company of unsupervised children? You know. Imagining myself leagues beyond the other children, I couldn't let my exhilaration show and spent most of my time keeping his ashtrays clean and replenishing his blood of Christ until I realized that Father Andy had no intention of leaving the priesthood for me. In fact, he seemed to have a very hard time remembering my name, even after I blithely posited the question of whether he thought it was possible that God might be a woman. An absurd idea that I thought might just be original enough to capture his attention. He barely noticed me at all. Stung by his ability to resist me, I mean, how did he do it? I grew tired of being his bottomless glass. I decided to tell my mom that my beloved priest was just a washed-up booze hound, you know, to give her the opportunity to agree with me. But incredibly, she took his side. A glass of wine? Oh, God. I hope he was smoking something a little stronger than tobacco. Poor fag. I should introduce him to Carl. She thought that any member of the priesthood who was passably handsome was just an adorable closeted homosexual who would benefit from exposure to Carl, one of her many fun, freewheeling gay friends. I had no idea what she was getting at. No matter. Jesus understood that we had obstacles to overcome in our long-distance relationship, and I dove back in with a refreshed sense of purpose. I had already read The Thorn Birds, so I knew what I was getting myself into. It would be difficult for Jesus to take time away from being the Son of God, but in my case, it would be worth it. I was willing to wait for him. We could spend our days innocently rolling around on the beach and caressing each other mournfully, knowing that the requirements of his job would make it impossible for us to ever consummate our love. Thankfully. Because even though I knew all about sex, and by that time my Barbies were all swinging naked from the chandeliers, I personally still found it revolting. It wasn't easy being so Catholic around my parents. They were forcefully non-religious, but they hadn't really been in the picture when my grandmother had done all the decision-making about my education. if either of them had had their way, I would have gone to the atheist school for the children of heretics and pagans. My father couldn't even talk about religion without lighting up like a Christmas tree, an angry one that would spit razor-sharp needles, spark up and burn the house down, taking everyone with it. Once he got started, you couldn't stop him. He referred to all religious people as Jeebus Freaks and TMRs, which stood for the mentally retardeds. Then he would feel guilty for a second and soften a little. It's not their fault they're so stupid. I feel sorry for them. I really do. Dolly dimwits. He may not have cared if we all went to hell, but he definitely cared about not being caught by my stepmother swearing in the presence of a child. And then he would ramp up again. Why not just believe that Goldilocks and the Three Bears were Jesus's siblings? He thought that calling Jesus Jesus H. Cripes or Jesus H. Crackers was hilarious. Let me ask you something. What was God's inspiration for creating fondue? Did he get tired of eating all those sea creatures and birds? Woo! Let's dip some bread into a cauldron of melted cheese. Delicious! Way to go, God! As a Jeebus freak myself, I did not appreciate his sarcasm. But as a model Catholic, I turned the other cheek and chose to take the high road, quietly praying for a cure for his heathenism. Failing that, I prayed that he wouldn't get smoted too hastily and decided to keep the magnitude of my secret love for Jesus on a need-to-know basis. My parents imagined that, given the opportunity to make my own decision about my faith at a much later age, I would ultimately decide to reject religion entirely, as they themselves had done. But as it turned out, at the age of 7, I was eager to be baptized. Thanks to the movie Jaws, which my stoner cousin had snuck me into, I had developed an intense fear of dying and knew for sure that it was imminent. I knew there was no way I was going to make it to my 8th birthday, and I didn't want to end up boiling in my own skin, courtesy of the devil. Jesus and I were going steady by that time anyway, so it was time to make things official. My grandmother was thrilled, her joy tempered only by the extreme embarrassment of having had an unbaptized child in the household for so long. We kept the ceremony from my father because we were afraid that he would lay an egg if he knew about it. So there I was, resplendent in the family tartan, transforming into an ultra-Catholic before my grandmother's tearful eyes and my mother's horrified ones. Ever since I could remember, my mother had found my religiousness charming and slightly alien. She didn't rally too hard against it first, but every time she came into my room, she shuddered at the sight of Jesus, his picture tacked to the wall above my bed, holding his robe open to reveal his sacred heart entwined with a crown of thorns and emitting a single drop of blood. My mother playfully insisted that, given his provenance, Jesus would have more likely been swarthy, maybe even a bit black, than silken-haired and ethereally pale with luminous blue eyes. More Cat Stevens than Kris Kristofferson then. She described the lack of hygiene in his time, implying that he probably would have been unwashed and slightly smelly, not strawberry-scented and manscaped the way I imagined him. Since I had an extreme paranoia about dirty feet and walking barefoot, I didn't appreciate her assertion that Jesus most likely didn't have shoes and that the soles of his feet were tough and black, or her notion that he probably didn't even speak English. What? The official name she gave him was Sweaty Bohunk, which was specifically designed to piss off my grandmother, since that's what she liked to call taxi drivers and gardeners. I ignored my mother completely and threw myself deeper into my religious training, preparing to receive sacrament number 2, communion. My grandmother and I went shopping for a pattern for the perfect dress, which we were having custom made with loads of glamorous white marabou trim. I took extra classes learning all about the body and blood of Christ and raised money for the Catholic Children of Guatemala by selling candies and Jesus-themed candles. Only for the Catholic children, though. My mother decided to pull out the big guns. She was determined to open my mind if she had to jam a crowbar in there and physically pry the two halves of my brain apart. It was time to introduce me to her religion of choice, Wicca. I didn't know anything about her faith other than the fact that it was something my grandmother couldn't bear to think about and that it involved congregating somewhere on the wrong side of the tracks. All I had seen of it up to that point involved rubbing special oils on various amulets and running out from time to time to bathe pebbles and seeds in the light of the full moon. I suspected that it was evil on some level, but I was willing to let it slide for the sake of my mother. For reasons nobody could fathom, she decided that the best thing to do would be to bring her 8-year-old super Catholic daughter into a dark room full of white witches to witness the union of two members of the coven. The coven met once a week above a store that sold Wiccan supplies and magic bath salts to the lovelorn. To say that I was out of my element would be the understatement of the century. From the moment I entered the building, I felt that I was under siege, and by the end of the evening, Satan would be tap dancing his way into my heart with his little goat hooves, stealing me away from Jesus for good. I fingered the St. Jude medallion that I had slipped into the pocket of my jumper and started praying. Everyone ran to the door to greet us, delighted by the exciting prospect of heathenizing an 8-year-old. I was paralyzed with fear. It was like looking at the cast of the Pirates of Penzance as costumed by a sixth-grade home economics class. Headscarves, knickers for those who chose to wear pants, men in billowing blouses, women in hand-sewn dresses festooned with multiple belts to hold up their pendulous breasts, unencumbered by bras. I'm totally picturing this. It's horrible. A man in a homemade sprout costume and cowboy boots sauntered by, his testicles dangling below the peekaboo-length dress he had crafted out of felt. With all of this shirt-cocking going on, there sure was a lot of graying genitalia on display. I guess foundation garments were not required by any of the Wiccan commandments carved into their sacred stone tablets. We were, however, all required to take off our shoes and socks, which I found disgusting. Instantly choking back tears, I looked at all of those dirty feet whose juices were soon to be mingling with mine. And as soon as I did, I felt certain that someone had cast an athlete's foot hex on me. My feet tingled with fungus, just thinking about stepping down onto that flatbed of foot disease. And then he appeared, the man-witch. At about 7 feet tall by 4 feet wide, he materialized in the doorway in his purple crushed velvet robe with a crooked walking stick in one hand and a joint in the other. His body hair was so unkempt and his eyes so wild. He looked vaguely Cujo-like, but smelled sweet, like sandalwood mixed with pot. From everyone's hushed tones, I could tell he was the big enchilada of the coven. His real name was Robert, but his craft name was Sunthorn. I called him the Man-Witch. My mom beamed when she saw him and gave me a little shove toward him. He swiftly entered my personal space and greeted me warmly. I interpreted this to mean that my virgin body was to be sacrificed to Satan momentarily, and so I silently prayed even more fervently to Jesus for protection. I prayed as we all entered the sacred space and found a place to sit on the pentacle made of masking tape. I prayed as they sprinkled grass seeds behind our backs and recited incantations about nature and the spirits in the trees. I prayed as they passed a cup from lip to lip and prayed as I refused to drink it for fear of the cold sore incantation that was probably swirling around inside. I was not having any part of it. And when they turned off all the lights to celebrate the sacred union of two of the coven's membership in satanic partnership, or so I thought, I prayed hardest of all, tears slipping down my cheeks as the two lovebirds joyfully ran around our circle, jumping over the broomstick and the cauldron of fire. Amid this flurry of activity, I had questions. Would Jesus think that I was cheating on him by being here, or would he be able to look into my heart and know that my intentions were pure? What if I accidentally said Satan's name 3 times in my head? Does just thinking about Satan really invite him into your heart? Or do you have to personally invite him the way you have to do with vampires? And does it count if you say Satan's name 3 times in one paragraph like I just did, or is non-consecutive usage okay? Whatever the answers to these manifold questions, it was at that point that I agreed to devote my life to service if I were to make it out alive. In Catholic speak, that meant caring for lepers and taking handicapped people grocery shopping. I hoped for the latter, but didn't dare pray for that on top of everything else. I ran through a list of all my sins up to that point. I was sorry that I had tried to rat out Father Andy for the sin of enjoying a glass of wine from a box. I shouldn't have pretended to accidentally drop my clog from the third floor of the mall when I totally did it on purpose and actually wanted it to fall on someone's head. And it was not my place to suck all the chocolate off the almonds intended for the Guatemalan Children's Rescue Mission and then force my grandmother to pay for them anyway. Up to that point in the Wiccan wedding ceremony, I had effectively concealed my terror. Everyone interpreted my silence as shyness and let me have my own contemplative space. But when the metal tub came out, it was game over for the little religious zealot in the cowl neck sweater. Was it going to be death by drowning, or was the tub just a catch basin for the bloodletting, which I assumed they would be ecstatically smearing all over themselves after I was gone? I burst into sobbing tears. The floodgates were open. This was it, I thought. Time to climb into the tub and accept my fate. But actually, it was time to bob for apples. I refused the apple bob just on principle. It seemed too much like Frenching, and I didn't really need to be swapping spit with pagans, especially since so many of them had dipped their straggly beards in the water by then. My mother rolled her eyes at me. She had been watching me on the verge of collapse the whole time and wondering how someone as cool as she was could have spawned someone as uptight as me. Even I started to feel like a bit of a drip as I took in the smiling faces of my mother's witch mates. They may not have been conventionally minded. They may have looked like a ragtag bunch of misfits huddled together in communal rejection of their parents' values and the wearing of pants. But at least they had one another, and maybe for them that was enough. With Satan nowhere in sight, I had to ask myself, would Jesus really condemn these people to hell for all eternity just for not believing in him? The answer, of course, was yes. But at least I was no longer afraid of them. Afterward, there was a potluck to celebrate the wedding of the happy couple. Everyone brought either Swedish meatballs still in the saucepan or a box of donuts, like we did. I was unimpressed with the spread, but everyone else seemed really excited, so I helped myself to a couple of Boston creams anyway. The members of the coven gave the couple a sacred wizard-looking thing, which I have to assume was a bong, and ushered them out to a van parked on the street that had blackout curtains and 20 minutes left on the meter. No one wanted to say the words fuckmobile, but that's what it was. Everyone found my naivete adorable. The man witch had changed into jean shorts and a Coors Light t-shirt by then, and he chatted with my mother for a while about seeds and stuff. Then everyone started exchanging herbs and plants that they had force-rooted for one another. It went from being a dangerous and seamy den of iniquity to a good housekeeping coffee clatch in 5 seconds flat. They were abnormally normal. It seemed like the only requirement for membership in the Wicca Club was a green thumb and a raging desire to feel like some part of something counterculture. In fact, they were downright boring. As my fear of imminent death dissipated, I started to rethink the commitment I had made to full-time Catholic service. Oh, sure, I still dreamed of the possibility that Jesus would come to Earth and tickle my back nonstop for an hour and a half while I made him a lanyard. But wasn't it enough to be Jesus' girlfriend from afar? I had his ear. Maybe I could just put in a good word for the lepers. I wasn't much good to anyone if I contracted leprosy myself anyway. That night, I prayed to Jesus for the last time. I prayed for the wayward souls of those happy Wiccans that they would someday see the value of a well-worn pair of corduroys. I prayed for the lepers that they would still have legs to slip into their flannel pajama bottoms. And I prayed that my mom would buy me the Sergio Valente jeans I so desperately needed to lure my secular crush, Joey, into the closet for 7 minutes in heaven so I could get closer to first base and to my main squeeze, JC, at the same time. What would Jesus do? Well, it's arrogant to think that mere mortals can decipher the mind of Jesus, but if I had to guess, I'm pretty sure he'd totally approve of the jeans. That's it. Thank you. Oh, thank you. I hope you are all successfully imagining pantsless Wiccans. I think we're going to do some questions now. So if you have a way that you like to do this, I think you're going to go into the audience with the microphone.
Actually, I'm not.
Oh, you're not.
Stand up here.
So you're going to stand up. Oh, okay. Nice.
A mic. So the gentleman in the front row right here. Sir, could you wait for a minute,
I just wanted to say, my name is Atasho Maloney, J-Mac by Atasho Abdul Maloney. I have a demo shop in agreement with Talent 2K.
Nice.
I just wanted to ask, how can I do some comedy today?
How or can you do some...
something that Talent 2K may be able to shop my demo to... contract.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm very connected. And I hold the key to a lot of people's futures, so maybe we should talk afterwards. Do you have a stage act? Oh, nice. Oh, that's great. I don't have anything on that subject, but perhaps we can, yeah. I think you need to start writing. Get in there. Okay.
And we'll continue on here, folks. Who's next? Third row right here.
Oh, yes.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering if you have...
Oh, sure. Of course. Go ahead. No, I don't mind. No.
I was wondering if you have any particularly funny story about interviewing someone for The Daily Show when their opinions are so totally... opposite from yours.
Oh, yes. You know, it, did everybody heard that question, right? Okay. Well, I do have a story, but it's an old story, but it's kind of a good story because it ended so badly. Well, it's sad, actually. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Now I feel like I have to do this. Okay. Can you hear me talking like, it was better before. All right. Oh, yes. This is nice. Okay. It is really, because we spend a lot of time with our interview subjects. So if we disagree with them ideologically, which we very often do, they are terrible. We have terrible, terrible days that are soul crushing. Because you kind of have to, I'm not saying that you would, you know, we spent, by way of example, Jason Jones, who is also works on the show and is my husband, just the other day spent the whole day with a homophobe. And those are really the worst for us because they're so vocal about everything and have the most crazy theories about things. And I think that the gentleman, I use the term loosely, that he spent the day with, is making some kind of case that the Nazis were all gay. And it doesn't make any sense to me. I'm not really sure what the logic of it is. But he spent basically eight hours with them. And although he wouldn't, you know, outright agree with that person, you have to be very nice to them if you want them to talk to you. And so you know it's a weird kind of chumminess that you have to kind of participate in with these people, and it is very soul destroying. So by the end of the day, Jason was practically in tears. I mean, he really came home and he was like, "I can't do this anymore." And he was going out with all of these very specific jokes, and he saw John right after doing the day with this guy, and John was like, "How did it go?" And Jason was like, "I don't know. It was awful. He's a horrible man." the piece will air shortly. But I look for it. It should be very funny. It was very hard on Jason. But I spent the day with a homophobe years ago. He was in Florida. His name was Ed Heaney. He was great. He felt that the gays were advancing their agenda. And because of the gay agenda, there were no white women left for him to date because they were all turning into lesbians and communal personally rejecting him as though that was like the only reason that you could possibly, you know, reject him because you turned into a lesbian. We had many wonderful winning qualities. Horrible. And by the end, I was working with a female producer as well. So it was just the two of us with Ed all day and his friend, his buddy, who was equally stupid. And by the end of the day, you could see them conspiring to have an orgy with the two of us. They just thought we were going to be into a big four-way with them. It was just absolutely disgusting. And then he looked so bad in the piece. He coined the phrase, the term homo-nosic, because the gay agenda was making him so nauseous that he wasn't, like, he didn't hate gay people, but he was just homo-nosic. And then about 6 months later, and he kept in touch with Bronwyn, the female producer, because I didn't give him my card, actually. I just knew that he would call. And he called her constantly. And then one day when she was in the middle of some other shoot, he still had her cell phone number, and he called her in the middle of a shoot, and he was barricaded into his hotel room in Florida, and the SWAT team was outside his door, and there were helicopters out at circling the hotel, and he was about to be, and he was looking to her, he was like, a Daily Show producer could help me, right? I'm under siege! And I think she just kind of hung up on him, and I'm certain that he's definitely in prison. There's no question. I don't know for what. Something bad. Poor, oh, God. Anyway, yes, those are our days. Not a typical day, but, you know.
Hi, my name is Brian B.
Hi. Oh, really? Okay.
Are you really part of an old car theft ring, I heard?
Well, I was one of, it was a small ring. It was more like a short line because it was really just my boyfriend and I. And, yes, we were not... I kind of thought we were like Bonnie and Clyde. Super cool. I was 15. I wasn't even old enough to drive a car. And we stole cars together for about a year and a half. And we would sell... Oh, it's so awful. I can't believe I have a job today. I don't deserve to have a job. We would steal people's cars and steal the stuff out of the cars and sell the car stereos and whatever we could sell. And then we would throw these massive parties in hotels for our teen friends. We weren't even doing drugs or anything. There's no excuse. We were just evil children doing a terrible thing. But I was much more in, I wasn't very good at it. Like I didn't have to do, he sort of did the technical work, although I could fudge it. I could do it. I can't do it anymore. There's two computer, there's too many computers in cars now. I could try. If you have an old car, let me go out in the parking lot and see if I can boost it. But I was very ambitious with it, and I thought, well, you know what we should do? We're so good at this. We should move to Miami Beach and start our own crime syndicate. And I bought my plane ticket, and he chickened out at the last minute. Thank God. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, yes, true. Also, in the book. I never got caught. No, we never got caught. But I feel that I've paid my price. I paid the price, too. Cosmically, I paid the price. Believe me.
Next question.
Now that the Daily Show has been on for a while, how, when you initially started interviewing people, you had anonymity, but don't people recognize you? Isn't it getting harder and harder to be incognito when you do the interviewing?
Well, we don't do the interviews incognito at all, and we never have. We've always stated where we are from. They have to sign a release before they start talking, which has Comedy Central right at the top of it in large, bold font. And we don't mislead people as to where we're from ever anyway. More people watch the show now. It's true. But an awful lot of people claim to watch the show and don't because they think it makes them seem cool. So that works to our benefit as well. But, I will say, I did this piece by way of example. I can only really remember, I remember Ed Heaney pretty specifically, but I, you know, we worked so in such volume that I only really remember very recent pieces. And I just did this piece the other night with these Catholics, with this, oh, thank you, with these nuns and priests. And they were aware of our show, but they don't watch our show. And they're nuns and priests. They don't, you know, they don't watch, I can't believe it, they don't watch Comedy Central, what? They don't have laptops? They weren't on Hulu or wherever you can find our stuff. But their PR person, because they have, you know, they have public relations people, they're the ones that connected that group with us. So it's really the PR people's fault in that, because they were not at all happy with the experience. They did not enjoy it at all. They were very worried, and they made the whole thing a huge hassle, because they just weren't familiar enough with it, but there was not much they could do about it. Once the cameras are rolling, the cameras are rolling. So, you know, I think I'm not answering your question. It hasn't really hindered us that much. It's always been difficult to book subjects. It's just that our subjects are a slightly more sophisticated now than they were 7 years ago, slightly, and not always. Again, Nazi homophobe, so, you know, he's easy to book. And he doesn't have anything going on. But I will say, you know, but in the example of the Catholic Church, I mean, they're using us as much as we're using them. They have a message that they want to get out, and we want them to talk to us. So there's a, you know, there's a quid pro quo. I can't say it. You know what I mean? I'm tired. Okay.
Another question? Yeah, in the black in the center.
Hi.
Please wait for the mic.
My husband and I are both lawyers, so dinner time has always kind of been a cross-examination.
Uh-huh, okay. Sure.
What's it like with two comedians as parents?
It's so boring. You know, it is. It's not as exciting as it would seem that it might be. But we are just like any other. I mean, we're just like any other parent. We try to laugh. I mean, we definitely try to laugh as much as humanly possible. But we have a lot of... Do you share an office with your husband? Do you work together? Okay. Well, we do. We share an actual office, side-by-side desks. We are together all the living time. Jason loves it. When he goes to the bathroom, he goes to the bathroom for an hour and a half. I'm just saying. I don't know what he's doing in there. I knock. I try to get in, but he doesn't let me in. I get the children to knock on the door, because he'll open the door for them. It's actually good for us to work together because we do all of our whatever adult talk is, dirty talk. No, we don't do dirty talk. But you know what I mean? We talk like normal people when we're together because when we get home, we're just like everybody else and we just like hit the floor. We're just cleaning the floor and changing a diaper and washing faces and running around and sweating. We just get home and start sweating. It's such hard work. And then at the end of the day to wind down, we're trying to watch The Wire. It's pretty serious in our home. We give ourselves 1 hour together to watch The Wire at 10 p.m. every night. We don't know what we're going to do when The Wire is done. We're dull, right? That's dull. It's not a cavalcade of humor, although we try.
Right in front here.
First of all, thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And how did you first get the job at Comedy Central? And you were hired before Jason?
Yes, I was. I got to make up a good story for this. It's not a good story. I was working I'm Canadian. I'm a citizen of Canada so far, working on my citizenship. I was working as a comedian in Toronto. And so was Jason. And I was doing a lot of sketch comedy and stuff like that. But The Daily Show didn't know who I was or anything like that. I didn't really have a high profile. Maybe a slight profile in Toronto. Nothing huge. And they actually physically came to Toronto to audition women in particular. And so I was very lucky to get an audition. and I read for them, and they liked me. And then they brought me to New York about 5 weeks later, and I met John, and I almost had a heart attack because it was really scary, although he was very nice. And so it was really just a very traditional audition process for me. So it was completely discombobulating. It was changed. It uprooted our lives completely. I moved to the States. Jason stayed in Toronto because he was working quite a bit. He's, you know, he's always been a working actor. So I was alone in New York. Oh, it was really hard. And then 2 years, so I started doing the job, and then he moved down with me. And then about 2 years later, he had done a series of commercials for Budweiser that were very funny. Probably none of you saw them. They were very funny, trust me. They hardly made it anywhere, except that the executive producer at The Daily Show happened to see them. And they liked him, and they didn't know that he was my husband. It's really crazy. They didn't actually know he was my husband. And they wanted to audition him, and then someone said, you know, that's Samantha's husband. And they were like, what? How is that possible? It was very random. And so then they came to me and asked me if I would mind if they auditioned my husband. And I said, don't you dare. He's an asshole. No, I didn't. I was very happy. I was very happy. And they auditioned him, and then he got the job. He kind of got it part-time, and he wormed his way into a full-time job. And now I don't know what happens when the job ends. We're going to die. We're going to dry up. But anyway, that's the story. I have to make it about orphans, saving orphans from a burning building.
All the way in back.
Hi.
Hi.
A couple of quick questions.
Sure.
Do you pitch stories, or is it story assignments, or a combination?
It's a combination. Yeah, it's a combination.
Okay, and the other question I had is, it seems like I've been watching the show for years, and at any given time, there's only one woman. I don't know why you think that is.
I don't really know why. None of us know why that is, to be honest with you. I can't really answer that question. I mean, I know they're trying out someone new now, which is great. And there have been a smattering of women over that time period. Kristen Shaw was with us for a little while, and she was really great. But I think she's just moved on, honestly, career-wise. It doesn't pay that much, I'm just saying. You know, she has probably moved on to a better-paying job. And there were lots of women before me. So there has been a kind of a period where I have been the only visible female face of the show. But they have always wanted that. They have always wanted to change that. They have made great efforts to do that. They just haven't found someone that they really liked. Honestly, it's this weird. I'm not 100% sure what they're looking for, but I'm pretty sure what they found in me was someone who looks like a reporter who's been at it for 20 years. Do you know what I mean? It's a very, and comics, I think they've seen so many comics over the years that were just so young, and they didn't feel just physically projected the image of someone who had been at it for a while. And I think that's probably the main reason, because they have certainly tried.
A few more, also in back, right there.
I've read the book. I think it's called America, and I enjoy your comments.
Oh, thank you.
And I can't remember. I used to smoke a lot of marijuana. What year did John Stewart take over from Craig Kilborn?
Did he take over in 1990, maybe 99, something like that. Okay. He was there before, definitely. I came down in 2003, and he had been there. He was there for 9/11. So I think it was maybe 2000 or 1999.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and on our left.
Could you name three people that you'd like to interview?
Oh, three people that I would like to interview. You know what? I don't think I can do that, because I don't actually like to interview prominent people. So they are terrible to interview. Anyone with a profile? I mean, John likes to interview people with a profile, you know, and it's great when people who are famous or noteworthy or intelligent or have credentials are on the show because it brings attention to the show. But I actually just far prefer to interview normal people or people who feel passionately about something. I hate interviewing people who are famous in any way because they have handlers and PR people, and they're too savvy. It's hard to, they're just so hard. They're so difficult. They outwit me. I don't like it. I can't think of three people that I would like to interview, personally. Jesus, perhaps? No, I'm not sure. That's a good question, though. I'm going to think of an answer for that, and then the next time someone asks me that, I'll have a great answer. I'll credit you. Thank you.
How about six rows back here on the aisle?
Oh.
Lady in the blue.
Two questions. One is, how many women writers do you have?
And right now we have two.
You have two. Okay.
Yeah.
And the other is, like, how many writers are there, and how does it, could you sort of like describe how a story or how an opening skit gets from start to finish?
You mean one of the field pieces or
one or the other? I mean, I assume it's
sure.
Although I assume the ones that come, you know, at the top of the show are more topical and faster.
Well, there are two main components that comprise our show. One is the headlines, the headlines, which John does, and then there's the field pieces, which we do. And we're very much more involved in the field piece aspect of that. But we have, how many writers do we have? We have at least 12, plus John, who is, you know, who writes the majority. I mean, John writes an awful lot of what he says, and there is a head, you know, there's a head writer, and the other executive producers also write. So it's a pretty big team. They get to work at about 9 a.m., 8:30 or 9, and decide what the major stories of the day are, and then the headlines get pitched to John. John is the executive, I mean, he is truly the voice of the show. You know, everything that is on the show has gone directly through John. And so the show is very much his voice. I mean, all of our voices contribute to it, but his voice is the final voice. You know, it's the last stop on the train. It's the first stop on the train and the last stop on the train. So, which is great because his voice is so genius that we are very thankful for that. So, you know, story, you know, the headlines get pitched in the morning. He decides which headlines interest him the most. They work further on those headlines. Then there's another meeting where they kind of, the writers jam on everything, and then he reads through everything and decides what he likes. And then there's a rehearsal at 4 o'clock, and we go through the whole show, and then the whole show is thrown away, and it is all rewritten. Between 4 o'clock and 5:15. Generally speaking, there's a lot of rewriting that goes on for sure. and in terms of the field pieces, there's a whole other department that takes care of that, of individual producers and correspondents. So stories are pitched by whomever, by a correspondent, by a producer, sometimes by a PA, really. Anyone can is free to pitch whatever they want. And it's a very collaborative effort, as in, you know, you can, if you see something that's very random that you think is funny, you should definitely mention it to them, because if they haven't seen it, they'll jump on it. So everybody's throwing out ideas. And then, in the field department, so when a story, and John decides what stories we're doing. So all of these ideas get pitched to the field department. Through the field department of stories that we'll shoot outside. And then he decides which ones he wants to pursue out of, let's say, a package of 15. Once a week, there's a package that is distributed to everyone of 12 or 15 field piece ideas. And he goes through them, and if he likes one of them or two of them, that's when we get the direction to start working on those. But he selects the ones that he likes. And then with a huge staff, we research the stories and it's a difficult process because really booking people is difficult. It takes a long time. Deciding on the elements of the story takes a long time. There's a lot of background work. So the field pieces are much more, they take weeks to put together. Just logistically, they take a long, long time. And we spend a lot of time with people, and we throw away a lot of footage that we think is hilarious. But if it just doesn't, it just sometimes doesn't fit into the narrative of the piece. So everything takes a while in that respect. I don't think I answered your question at all. I may not have. I'm just babbling. I'm enjoying it. I like the sound of my own voice on this microphone.
We have time for a few more. Lady right here in the fourth row. If you could wait for the mic, it's coming right to you. And then the gentleman up there who has his hand up.
On the way in today, I listened to Terry Gross on NPR, and she was interviewing the journalist from Iran who spoke to Jason.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And was imprisoned after that.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering...
Yes, that's correct.
What are some comments on that story?
Now I can't, of course, I've just gone brain dead. I know him, and I can't think of his name, but anyway, I'll think of it. Jason went to Iran last year, around this time, beginning of June of last year. They went just prior to everything blowing up in Iran. Like, they were gone, really, the day before everything just exploded, the day before the election happened. And he spoke to a lot of, it was very difficult getting the clearance to go there. They had to go through like the State Department. It was a whole thing. And, it probably took 6 to 9 months to get that story in place of just constant work and permits and finding, because you have to, when you're there as a journalist, you have to have a fixer who is the connected person who, you know, finds the interview subjects for you, kind of people who will talk to you and decides where you can and cannot go and decides what you're limited by while you're there so that nobody gets arrested, you know, all of those things. It's like the, you know, your point person there, and security, and he has guns to keep you safe. I was excited when Jason went to Iran. Believe me, I was really happy that he was gone for 2 weeks to Iran. But it was fine. He had such a great experience there, and he talked to so many amazing people, and including the journalist from Newsweek. He's Canadian, and I cannot remember his name at all, which is so embarrassing, but I can't remember anyone's names. And a lot of people went to jail after Jason talked to them. Yes, but nobody has made Jason feel responsible for that, although he carried that burden in his heart. He was mortified because they were just getting picked off one by one. He just kept hearing about the people that he had spoken to there being sent to prison. And he thought that it was his fault and so forth. But the truth is that all of the people that he spoke to had liberal leanings or intellectual leanings that they would have been arrested anyway. But they did happen to speak to him, and it was kind of a coincidence that was horrible. And they did speak about him in the interrogation because they watched the piece, and they did not watch it with humor. Yeah, they watched it very unironically and thought that Jason was a spy and that Jon Stewart was a spy for, you know, for the Jewish agenda. And it was a whole thing. But Jason is friends with him now. They see each other frequently. And, of course, Iranians in America and in Canada loved the pieces because they were great. Because the truth is, the normal Iranian people are delightful and wonderful people that are so misunderstood. And anyway, that's how. It's a sad story, but Jason did feel extremely guilty, and then his guilt was assuaged in the end, but he felt very responsible for some time. It was terrible.
Okay, gentlemen here.
When you're dealing with someone like the Nazi homophobe,
yep,
and you help facilitate their self-destruction on the air,
mm-hmm,
do you ever feel badly for that person? Maybe not the Nazi homophobe, but others.
No. No, I don't. I don't because, well, I just don't. But it is weird though, because sometimes they're so out to lunch that they watch the piece and then they call you afterwards and they're like, great piece! I looked amazing! I did a really good job and I really got my point out there. So there's a different, there are a lot of different interpretations, you know, that can be had from these things. So often they're not nearly as horrified as they should be, but they don't have a great sense of self-awareness. Let's just say that to begin with, because I mean, really, I don't feel bad. I do feel badly when, well, I'm just going to keep, I don't mean to harp on this Catholic thing, but it was like a whole, it was a whole problem. Because they were very unhappy with the way that the interview had taken place. They were not happy with one thing in particular. And I will tell you what it was. They were so upset by this one thing. And basically what happened was we were interviewing, we positioned the Goldman Sachs against the Catholic Church. And, you know, we were trying to make a case that Goldman has a worse PR problem than the Catholic Church, which is like nearly impossible right now. And so we interviewed this former Goldman banker, and I called him a turbo douche to the Catholics. When we interview people, we try to make them fight. You know, we interview someone over here, we try and, you know. So when I was talking to the banker, I was like, the priests and nuns called you a turbo douche. What would you like to say to them? And because that's where you have to kind of do that. And it ended up that one of the nuns and one of the priests, I mean, they just have no awareness of anything kind of. First of all, they didn't know what a douche was. Like, just physically, they had never heard the word before, which I found amazing. I mean, they were not young people. You've never heard the word, like, in your life? You don't know what a douche is? I understand that you haven't heard, you know, you've referenced, you know, you haven't called someone a douche. I can understand that if you're a priest or a nun. But anyway, so what happened was, I called the Goldman Sachs guy a turbo douche, and they just started saying it over and over again because they didn't know what it was. So, you know, so I said it to them, and then one of the nuns was like, a turbo douche? What in the heaven's sake is a turbo douche? Am I going to find the word turbo douche in the Old Testament? And then the priest chimes in, and he was like, well, that is a sick person. I've had it up to here with turbo douches. So they just kept saying the word turbo douche, which was so adorable. It was adorable. Because they didn't know what they were saying. It was beautiful. So, you know, I'm sitting there while the priests and nuns are saying turbo douche, and I'm like, and the producer was like, and then the PR person was in the corner having heart failure. So after that, they were very distressed by the idea that a priest or a nun had said the word turbo douche, even though it was, you know, everyone knew, you could tell that they just didn't know what it was and didn't know what they were saying. And it was very cute that they were trying to figure it out together. And so we put it in the piece because it was adorable. And then we told them in advance. We called them that day, which we don't typically, it's not typical for us to give a lot of warning about these things. But they were very sweet, and they were very problematic in other ways. They just kept calling. They were just, like, very anxious about it. So we did say, okay, well, there's this moment where Sister Barbara and Father Finn say turbo douche, and they just about, they died. I mean, they were hysterical. And they begged us not to put it in. And it was like it was very dramatic all day because It was so funny. It was so funny, them saying it, but they were so nervous to be seen saying that. And there's a lot of irrational firing that's going on in the Catholic, they're not firing the correct people in the Catholic Church, but they are firing people for very irrational things now, and they've got a real thing. They seem to have a vendetta against nuns right now. So they were so concerned that they were all going to lose their jobs. And I was like, listen, it doesn't appear to me that anyone gets fired from the Catholic Church, but okay. You think you're going to lose your, you know. So we had this kind of debate all day, and then in the end we took it out because you can't kill someone with a field piece. Like, you can't, you know, they were saying that it was going to ruin their lives. And we have no interest in ruining people's lives. It was greatly disappointing to us. And we were trying to communicate that it was very funny and not ruin us and didn't make them seem like they were really calling someone that or that they would use that kind of language normally. But they didn't believe us. And so we did make a change. So I don't know that that completely answers. I'm terrible at answering questions. But if, you know, if something's very hurtful and the person is innocent of something, we're not going to, not in the business of a takedown. So anyway, we put all our energy into different jokes. And I don't know if they were pissed by them either, but that was their main area of concern. We were like, you're not concerned about the, you know, the child rape stuff that's going on, but this is the big problem? And they were not, in fact. They were only concerned about the use of that phrase. But if they had been more evil people, we wouldn't have taken it out at all, and we would not have called them. And then that's the way it would have gone.
That was your moment of B.
Oh, thank you. Bless you. Bless your hearts.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Delightful.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.